Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Crassie Twigg from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we're asking, 10 years after the start of the war in Yemen, where do the warring parties stand? This battle between rival camps in the Middle East has reached a stalemate. Is there a way out? The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media, getting past the narratives, the propaganda and the disinformation. Find us wherever you get your BBC World Service podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. As Israel continues its military offensive against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and its bombing campaign of the capital Beirut, UN peacekeepers in the south are increasingly being caught up in the conflict. There are around 10,000 members of the UN's interim force in Lebanon, or UNIFIL, deployed in the south. But in recent days, there have been a number of incidents in which several members of the force have been injured as a result of Israeli fire seemingly directed at their positions. Speaking to the BBC, a spokesperson for UNIFIL in Beirut, Andrea Tenente, said the latest attacks appeared to be deliberate.
We have seen a lot in the last 12 months, exchanges of fire, but this time it looks more of a deliberate attack against our troops. When you fire at the cameras, when you fire at illumination inside the base, and the tower close inside the headquarters of the mission. So it's very something that we are still trying to ask the Israeli authorities for some explanation of what happened.
Well, Israel has previously asked UNIFIL to pull back from the Lebanon-Israel border, but it's refused to do so. And commenting on these recent incidents, the Israeli military has acknowledged that its forces fired at what it called a threat near a UN peacekeeping mission earlier today, and that in the process its forces hit a UNIFIL post, resulting in the injury of two UN personnel. And the statement continued that the IDF took every precaution to minimise harm to civilians and peacekeepers alike. We approached the IDF for an interview, but they said no one was available at this time. Speaking in Beirut, the Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati said that Israel was attempting to undermine the work of the United Nations.
We condemn the attack on UNIFIL forces by Israel. It is a crime which is directed at the international community. Targeting the United Nations Security Force violates its sanctity. I received a call from the US Secretary of State, and we discussed the serious efforts to stop the fire and the coordination that is taking place. I found full solidarity with Lebanon on all levels and discovered that they are striving with all their efforts to secure a ceasefire. And this was my demand, a ceasefire and at least a halt to the bombing of civilians and the damage that is happening to civilians.
There's also been international condemnation. President Emmanuel Macron said France would not tolerate what he called deliberate Israeli attacks against UN peacekeepers. The Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, said such attacks were unacceptable, while President Biden said he was asking Israel not to fire at the peacekeepers. Diplomatic efforts to end the conflict centre on trying to implement UN Resolution 1701, which requires Hezbollah to pull back north of the Litani River, which is 30 kilometres from the Lebanon-Israel border, and for Israeli forces to pull back across the border into Israel. Jean-Pierre Lacroix is UN Undersecretary General for Peace Operations, in other words, the head of UN peacekeeping. I've been talking to him about his forces in Lebanon and what's been happening to them in recent days.
It is, first of all, very worrying and concerning for Lebanon and the civilian population. But as it's known now, the peacekeepers have also been affected. We already had a number of peacekeepers injured. Thankfully, no life-threatening injuries and also a number of positions that were hit by indirect or direct fire.
You talk about direct or indirect fire. So you haven't concluded, have you, that Israel has been directly targeting UNIFIL positions in southern Lebanon?
Well, we have reason to believe that in some cases the fires have been directed. And for example, we've had a case where a tower was hit by a fire and also the damages to cameras at one of the positions, which obviously to us very much look like direct fire. But I think, you know, beyond the question of the sort of intentionality, what is really critical is the parties have obligations to respect the safety and security of the peacekeepers. And that would include, of course, avoiding anything that would threaten them. One is obviously to avoid firing in the vicinity or in a way that threatens the peacekeepers. Another thing is to avoid any positioning in the immediate vicinity of the UN position.
And that includes Israeli forces and Hezbollah positioning themselves near UNIFIL positions.
Obviously, yes, that includes Israel and Hezbollah.
Sorry to be rather blunt, but they are called UN peacekeepers. But what exactly is their role at the moment in southern Lebanon?
Obviously, their ability to fulfill their mandate is limited. It is not completely suppressed in the sense that our peacekeepers have been carrying out a number of activities, particularly with the aim of protecting the population. And obviously, they continue to be there also to provide the Security Council and the international community impartial and neutral reporting as they are mandated to do. It is important to stay where we are, to keep the position manned, because, first of all, we have a responsibility to our mandate. But in addition to that, abandoning the position would mean that they would probably be occupied very soon by others, and we don't want that either. So, of course, we're taking all precautionary measures to the extent possible to protect the peacekeepers. Those positions have been reinforced over the last couple of weeks. We've been making efforts to supply them for sustainability, but it is important to stay. Now, if you ask me, of course, the extent to which they can fulfill their mandate now is limited, but all the parties refer to Resolution 1701 as the framework for a political solution. And this is obviously what we're calling for as UN. Return to the negotiating table and the implementation of Resolution 1701.
The IDF has issued a statement in which it says that the UN Security Council Resolution 1701 has not been fully enforced and that Hezbollah violated it by establishing an extensive militarized presence in southern Lebanon. And that is their justification for moving against Hezbollah.
It is clear that Resolution 1701 has not been implemented. Now, what we hope is that this time around, there will be genuine efforts by the parties to implement that resolution.
Have you been in touch with the Israeli government, with the IDF, to try to find out what's going on?
We are in touch with, obviously, the Israeli authorities. We've conveyed to them both our concern regarding the safety and security of our peacekeepers. We have reminded them of their obligation. We keep in touch with them. I also should mention that the liaison mechanism between UNIFIL and the IDF continues to function, which obviously is very important. There has been a number of occasions where some activities, particularly with the purpose of resupplying some of the positions, have been made possible through deconfliction, or obviously there's also liaison with the Lebanese armed forces. But our call really to the Israeli authorities, and indeed our call to all parties, is to abide by the obligation of protecting the ceasefires and say their safety and security.
I mean, can you see a time maybe when it is no longer tenable or no longer safe for UN peacekeepers to be in southern Lebanon? This conflict seems to show no sign of abating.
What I can tell you is obviously we keep reviewing the situation. We have plans for all possible scenarios. And, you know, if there is an evolution that warrants an evolution in our posture, then we'll see what we do. Of course, we should be very attentive to how the situation evolves. And obviously, we put the safety and the security of our peacekeepers as our number one priority.
That was UN Under Secretary General for Peace Operations, Jean-Pierre Lacroix. The stated objective of the Israeli offensive in Lebanon is to stop Hezbollah firing rockets into northern Israel, enabling 16,000 Israelis to return to their homes. But it hasn't stopped yet. And over the past few days, there have been heavy Hezbollah rocket fire across the border around the northernmost Israeli border town of Metula. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson was taken into the town, now under military blockade, by the Israeli army.
The Israeli border town of Metula juts right up into Hezbollah territory. The Israeli army is taking us in. Nadav Shoshani is a military spokesman.
You can see now we're protected by the trees, but if there is a Hezbollah terrorist in there, he has a direct line of fire and has direct sight of us.
No one has lived here for a year except the military. In that time, half the houses have been hit by Hezbollah.
We're walking quickly up this road because it's part of the village that's exposed and in direct line of sight from one of the Lebanese villages. This community is perhaps the most exposed in Israel, surrounded by Lebanon on three sides. Part of it, too dangerous to even enter.
Israel's ground invasion of Lebanon began along this stretch of border. The mayor, David Azulai, shows us where a rocket landed in a house last week. It's the third time this house has been hit in the past few months. Then, sirens. Here, you have seconds to find cover. We hear Israel's air defences intercept the barrage overhead. Civil defence teams monitor Hezbollah activity around Metula 24 hours a day.
The goal of these cameras is to make sure there's no terror attack against.
We're taken into the war room, run by civil defence volunteers like Sharon.
Two, three, 4 weeks ago, we could still see some movements and activities from Hezbollah.
Every day?
Almost every day.
It's a narrow, cramped space, filled with more than a dozen screens, its cameras picking out the traces of Israel's invasion last week, and buildings destroyed in neighboring Lebanese villages.
In the last few weeks, because of IDF operations, they have moved back a bit or hid and focused heavier on projectiles and rocket fire rather than those suicide drones or direct fire like anti-tanks or RPGs.
160 rockets were fired at Metula on a single day last week. Another house was hit 4 days ago. The kind of attack Nadav Shoshani says Israel's invasion is meant to stop.
Hezbollah terrorists are within a few hundred meters from these houses. Right behind us, in that ridge, is Lebanon. And while IDF troops are operating, Hezbollah has been embedding itself and preparing for a war with Israel for decades, building bunkers and rockets under houses in southern Lebanon. We have to go. There's an alert, and okay. we'll keep on going.
Okay.
We leave to more warnings of rockets. Metula, a litmus test of Israel's war goals, is still empty of residents, not yet secure.
Lucy Williamson reporting from the northernmost Israeli border town of Metula. This year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Japanese anti-nuclear group Nihon Hidankyo, which is made up of survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki attacks. Speaking at a news conference in Oslo, the chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Jørgen Watne Friednes, made the announcement.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Peace Prize for 2024 to the Japanese organization Nihon Hidankyo. This grassroots movement of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, also known as Hibakusha, is receiving the Peace Prize for its efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons.
And speaking after learning about the award, the co-head of the organization, Toshiyuko Mimaki, said he hadn't expected it.
Never did I dream this could happen.
They selected Nihon Hidyanko. I thought those fighting hard for peace in Gaza would deserve it.
People in Tokyo certainly welcomed the prize, saying learning the lessons of the past was more important than ever.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the only cities that were exposed to atomic bombs during the war. They have harsh memories, and I think many people are still suffering today. I think it's very important for such people to convey to the world the tragedy of Japan in the form of the Nobel Peace Prize. I think it's very important that we Japanese pass on to the next generation what we've learned from our predecessors, because there's nothing more cruel than war. And the people of the past suffered greatly.
A voice from the streets of Tokyo, and Toshiko Tanaka lives in Hiroshima and is a survivor of the blast. She was 6 years old when it occurred, and she's worked alongside Nihon Hidankyo over the years. She spoke to my colleague James Menendez about how she felt about them winning the prize.
I am very glad. I can't believe it. It's true.
What do you think it means for the organization and its work?
So since after the World War II, Hidankyo, the organization, has been working very hard to tell the world the terror of the atomic bomb. And partly because of that, the nuclear weapon has been never been used in wars for nearly 80 years. However, it seems like there's a lot of fear going on in Russia, for example, and Israel. There is a growing concern that the nuclear weapon might be used again. So it is important for us to voice again.
Do you think that people are forgetting about the horrors of nuclear weapons and what they can do?
So I think the world is forgetting about the fear, the terror of the atomic bombing. However, there's a hope as well. I visited 18 countries this year. There, I met young activists all over the world. And there, these young people are working really hard, and they're starting to remember recognize the terror of the atomic bombing, nuclear weapons. And these people are taking what is going on in Russia or Ukraine as if it's their own things. So I have a lot of hope for this younger generation.
Toshiko, you were 6 years old, I think, when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. Do you still remember clearly what happened that fateful day?
Yes, I do. I clearly remember what happened. I'm 85, so I might sometimes forget what I ate yesterday, but I still remember what happened on that day. I saw an airplane in the sky. Then all of a sudden, there was a tremendous flash. And I got burned, my head and my neck. And right arm was burned. Then suddenly everything went dark because we are under the mushroom cloud. Then I went home. I went back to home, which was my house was entirely destroyed. Then my mother, didn't recognize me because I was covered by ash and my appearance was changed so much. And then I saw the procession of people who are severely burned, walking silently in the procession, and they look like zombies.
Yes, people sometimes describe them as ghosts, the ghosts of Hiroshima.
The ghost might be a better description.
And what was your experience in the years after 1945, how was your health, for example? How were survivors treated in Japan?
After the war, we lost everything. And however, for 6 years, the Japanese people were not informed about the radioactivity. So people knew nothing about it. So they built very humble houses and they started to grow vegetables on the contaminated soil. They drank, we drank water, contaminated water. We didn't know anything about the radioactivity. And it's said that 140,000 people has been killed by the atomic bombing. However, I know at least 10 of my friends or people that who died after that, and I suspect that was because of that radioactivity.
I understand you didn't speak about your experiences until you were 70. Why did you remain silent for so long?
あの、話すことはとても思い出すことが苦しいし、それと It was very hard for me to remember. And also, there was a discrimination in the society. And for example, your kids might be discriminated when they get married. So that is the reason why many people silence themselves.
Do you think nuclear weapons will ever be abolished now that the genie is out of the bottle?
I would like to believe in the wisdom of people or humanity. There's a lot of wars going on in Israel, Ukraine, and Gaza. And these things are happening because as the chain of retaliation. And I really want people to start talking and stop before it gets really the worst. And I really strongly believe in people's wisdom.
That was Toshiko Tanaka, Hiroshima survivor who's worked alongside Nihon Heidankyo, the winners of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. And we should also give our special thanks to her daughter, Reiko, who translated for us and whose voice you heard in that interview. And don't forget, if you want to listen to News Hour but missed the live broadcast, a podcast of the programme is available, updated twice a day. Just type into your search engine, BBC News Hour podcast, and you'll find it there. You can listen to a single edition, or better still, subscribe to the feed for regular downloads so you'll never need to be without us. Do stay with us, a lot more to come in the next 30 minutes.
I'm Crassi Twig from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we're asking, 10 years after the start of the war in Yemen, where do the warring parties stand? This battle between rival camps in the Middle East has reached a stalemate. Is there a way out? The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media, getting past the narratives, the propaganda and the disinformation. Find us wherever you get your BBC World Service podcasts.
You're with News Hour. And family members of those killed in two Boeing 737 MAX crashes are pushing a judge to reject a landmark plea deal between the company and prosecutors. A court in Texas has been looking at the case, which covers two separate crashes that killed 346 people in total in Indonesia and Ethiopia. Boeing has agreed to plead guilty to a single criminal charge of misleading regulators, but that's being challenged by relatives of those who died, who say the company put profits before safety. Our business correspondent Theo Leggett told my colleague Andrew Peach more.
There were two desperately tragic crashes involving Boeing's new aircraft, the 737 MAX. And in the aftermath of those accidents, which killed 346 people, it transpired that faulty design was at the root of it all, and that Boeing had put software on this aircraft that wasn't up to the job and had effectively hoodwinked regulators about the software that was being installed as well. Now, in the wake of those crashes, Boeing avoided prosecution, and it avoided prosecution by doing a deal with the Department of Justice under which it paid $2.5 billion in fines and restitution and agreed to be under probation for a certain period of time. And that seemed to be that. But then, at the beginning of this year, There was another incident involving the same aircraft, the 737 MAX, when a disused door panel fell off an aircraft shortly after takeoff. Nobody was seriously hurt, but if that incident had happened later in the flight, they could have been. And this focused a harsh spotlight on Boeing's safety standards and on its ability to clean up its act. The Department of Justice, in the aftermath, reopened its prosecution, reimposed a charge of fraud against Boeing, and moved forward with the prosecution. What we now have is a plea deal between Boeing and the Department of Justice, under which Boeing has agreed to pay a further fine of $244 million and accept further probation. And this hearing and the case that we have now is about whether or not that plea deal should be accepted.
Right, so the US judicial system often turns on these plea deals, which are unfamiliar to people in many other parts of the world. What are the implications of the outcome of this, whether the plea deal is accepted or rejected?
Well, in one sense, if it's accepted, it is historic. It is Boeing pleading guilty to a serious criminal charge. But this plea is being opposed by relatives of those who died in the two accidents because they claim it's letting Boeing get away with it, that it's basically a sweetheart deal. So the Department of Justice gets an easy conviction and Boeing gets away with paying a small fine and being under probation that it would probably have to suffer anyway. What the relatives are saying is that a much harsher penalty is needed, but also they want this case to go to trial because if the plea is rejected and another plea deal isn't reached, then there would be a trial with a jury, and that would mean exposure of an awful lot more of what's going on. There would be a level of transparency that the relatives argue we haven't yet seen.
That was our business correspondent, Theo Leggett. You're listening to NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. I'm Julian Marshall. The current conflict in Lebanon has tended to obscure Israel's ongoing offensive in Gaza, now in its second year. More than 42,000 people have been killed, according to Hamas, deemed a terror organization by a number of Western governments. And even though Israel this week declared that Hamas's military had been defeated, there's been increased fighting in the north of the enclave. And the medical aid charity MSF says the total evacuation of homes in the north and the bombing of neighbourhoods by the Israeli military was turning the area into what it called uninhabitable ruins. The charity said thousands of people, including five of its own staff, were trapped in the Jabalia refugee camp and that anyone trying to get out was being shot. Israel says its North Gaza offensive aims to stop Hamas regrouping. Well, the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza has been a focus of Israeli attacks since the offensive began last Saturday. Mohammed Salah is acting director of Al Awda Hospital in Jabalia.
There is the 7 day of siege Jabalia from Israeli occupation forces. Now, nobody can move from the northern governorate to Gaza City or come from Gaza City to north governorate and especially to Jabalia. And that from this time till now, there is a lot of bomb. There's bombing many places, many shelters, many houses. A lot of injured is coming to the hospitals. Now you are speaking with me and I have come from the emergency department. It's full of injured people who has come to Al-Awda Hospital. And the most important things that the Israeli is not allowed to WHO to enter any of medication and medical supplies. And especially they didn't allow to them to bring fuel to running the hospitals in the north. So Al-Awda Hospital in the north in Gaza, tomorrow we will not found any liter of fuel because it will finish and we don't have any fuel. So we will depend on the battery as well. So now it's full, but after 2 days maximum, this battery as well finish. So that will be really a disaster if there is no fuel.
So there have been Israeli air attacks, but are there Israeli ground forces in Jabalia as well?
Yes, the forces now is in, they are not entering all Jabalia. They are cutting Jabalia and Gaza now. But they are bombing inside Jabalia, but nobody can move. There is some areas in Jabalia camp, nobody can go there. It's like from the east to the west. Nobody can move there because the snipers and the quadcopter can shoot them or they can bombing them. But they are bombing inside Jabalia. They are bombing places, shelters and houses. And a lot of injured is coming to the hospitals nowadays.
There's been a lot of talk in Israel recently about implementing what's called the General's Plan in northern Gaza. And that plan involves the evacuation of the entire civilian population and the creation of a military zone, a combat zone in northern Gaza. Do you feel that is what is happening?
Yeah, but we hear about the plan of generals that the people has to evacuate all of the Gaza, the northern Gaza. I feel that they want to putting this number of people. Now maybe they are 100,000 person in the northern Gaza. So they will putting them under pressure, no food, no medication, no medical supplies, no healthy water, no fuel. So the people is pressure on these people to move directly to go to the south, or these people has to see that this area is not safe to stay and we have to go to the south to implement the general plans.
How do you cope, sir? How does your family cope with this day to day? How do you manage?
You can't imagine how is the bad situation that I live. My family is in the south and I am in the north. 1 year, I am not seeing my children and my wife and my mother. So from the beginning of this aggression, from 7th of October, they asked that the people has to go to the south because their life, the way I have sending them to Rafah and I have to taking care of my people here to work in the hospital. So, but now they are in a tent. The tent is, when it's raining, the tent is full of water and really they are living a hard situation. You can't imagine how they are live and how I am live now without this is a separation 1 year and we are a strong family and we can't manage our life. How is the poorest and marginalized family can deal with this situation? Really, we are living a disaster.
That was Mohammed Salam, the acting director of Al Awda Hospital in Jabalia in northern Gaza. And Gaza Civil Defense Agency says 30 people were killed today in Israeli strikes in Jabalia. So what is this so-called General's Plan? Is it now official Israeli government policy? The BBC's Wira Davis is in Jerusalem.
I don't think it's official government policy yet, although Benjamin Netanyahu has referred to it several times in his speeches over the last couple of days. It's clear that there is a new military directive in northern Gaza, around Jabalia and other places. It's almost like the Israeli military is encircling remaining Hamas fighters. The problem is, of course, that in doing so, they're encircling hundreds of thousands of civilians as well. Now, Israel has issued an order to those civilians under this directive to leave, but it seems that it's not as straightforward as that, and many civilians are still apparently trapped inside Jabalia and other cities and towns in northern Gaza as this operation, whether it's called the General's Directive or not, is clearly an enhanced Israeli military operation in northern Gaza.
And are troops being used in this new offensive in Jabalia, or is it purely airstrikes, whether from planes or these quadcopters that the manager referred to?
Oh, no, absolutely. Troops are being used and troops are being killed. Four Israeli soldiers, including a senior officer, were officially killed, were killed. And there was an official statement yesterday. And there have been other casualties on the Israeli side this week. So there are clearly Israelis on the ground coming under hand-to-hand fighting. Although, as the doctor suggested there, a lot of the offensive thus far has been from the air with helicopter gunships, shelling and reportedly the use of quadcopters as well to shoot would-be targets.
We've been getting some rather intriguing reports from Israel about the interception of aircraft, one, two, in the centre of the country. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, look, it's the holy weekend this weekend in Israel, the most important day in the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. So it's quiet generally across the country. Of course, that doesn't mean there's no military activity. And it appears that some projectiles and some drones have been fired from Lebanon towards central Israel tonight. And most of those will have been intercepted by Israel defense systems, but it appears that at least one projectile, whether it's a drone or a missile, has got through and has landed in Herzliya, which is just north of Tel Aviv. There are reported to be no casualties because there was an air raid warning at the time, but despite, of course, the holiday, the military activity does continue.
That was BBC's Wura Davis speaking from Jerusalem. President Biden is expected to visit Florida on Sunday, where people are returning to their homes to assess the damage caused by Hurricane Milton. The state's governor, Ron DeSantis, says the state may have avoided the worst-case scenario, but there have been widespread damage and at least 16 people are known to have been killed. Thousands have been rescued from flooded areas and 2.5 million homes and businesses are still without power. Mr. Biden said the storm had cost around $50 billion worth of damage. Our correspondent Tom Bateman reports from the town of Clearwater on Florida's Gulf Coast, where the hurricane made landfall.
This had memorabilia of mine since middle school, stuff from my dead grandmother.
Zane Jake Tucker's apartment is ruined.
All gone.
He walks me round, here on the ground floor, as mud and the debris of a palm tree litter the doorway.
This is the water line? Yeah.
This is the water line. I think this is where it stayed at, because when we were in the house, it was a bit higher.
Zane says there were no evacuation orders for these homes. Instead, he and flatmate Dania Fleury watched the waters rise helpless.
What are you able to grab?
What's in my hand right now? Are those your sinkers? I figured we'd take a case of water to your dad's house.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now he's come back to survey the damage. With the growing intensity of Florida storms, insurance costs have soared. Zane and Dania couldn't afford it, and she says they've lost everything. But at least they didn't pay with their lives. Outside his house, a car is flattened by a fallen tree. Zane grew up here, but he wonders how much longer he can stay. In the buildings next door, hundreds on the ground floor fled to neighbours upstairs when Milton came. They had to be rescued by boat at dawn. The storm arrived less than a fortnight after Hurricane Helene tore through this area, a community inundated with floodwater and fear.
What you can hear there is a giant pump that is trying to draw the water level down. Home upon home, a street that's really become a river. Cars that are submerged. I can see a motorbike with its windshield just sticking out of the ripples of the flood here. And the sense I get from residents here is just about how much more they can take. They've had two hurricanes back to back in a fortnight now. And some have asked the question how long they can keep going like this when the risk of this just seems to be getting worse and worse by the year.
Are you in the shelter at the moment?
We're just actually coming to grab our stuff to go home.
Can I ask your name?
Emily.
What happened to your home?
Actually, with Hurricane Helene, it was underneath 12 foot of storm surge, and then this one just, we tried to haul ass as quick as we could. Wow. So we're about to go see how much damage is at the house. So
you're already damaged from Helene. Mm-hmm. So you came here the night before Milton.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now you're going back for the first time. Do you know if you've got any damage?
We already know we're expecting it.
That will end around 5 this afternoon. Please keep those in the damaged areas in your prayers. Check this station's website.
On the car radio, the ads try to help lift the mood, even if they are for a roofing company.
This update brought to you by Covenant Roofing, where the difference is the promise. 833-4 Covenant.
We head east, following Milton's path, on a highway-side trail of flooding and debris. The hurricane had downgraded before landfall, sparing Florida the most dire warnings of the worst in a century storm. But there is still severe damage, and officials think 3 days of evacuation warnings from President Biden downwards saved many lives here. Some feel, though, they are now just counting time until the next major hurricane.
Our correspondent Tom Bateman reporting from Florida's Gulf Coast, where Hurricane Milton made landfall. This is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. President Paul Biya of Cameroon is the world's oldest head of state, and aged 91, there are inevitably questions about his health, and also because his public appearances are becoming more infrequent. But such speculation must stop, say the Cameroonian authorities. The president's health is now a matter of national security. Paul Ngea is the BBC reporter in Cameroon, and I put it to him that I assume he's also subject to the ban.
Yes, indeed, I am also subject to this ban. But then the Minister of the Interior Minister did say that it was for media practitioners in the country, especially at private media practitioners or professionals, warning them against, you know, hosting debates or having comments about the health condition of the president of the Republic. But this has not gone down well with some journalists whom I spoke with earlier today. They see this as some form of attack on press freedom, especially at a time when elections are coming up and also at a time when the ruling party is calling on President Paul Biya to seek another mandate. He's been in power for over 40 years. That's 41 years, 42 years now. So basically, the minister is saying that there should be no mention of the president's health on any broadcast media channel or on any outlet because it amounts to, it borders around issues of state security.
Has there been a lot of talk recently on social media about the president's health?
Yes, there has. There has been much talk, and that resulted in government reacting about it. Earlier this week, there were rumours about the ill health of the president, and some went as far as declaring him dead. The government had to come out in different platforms to say that the president was indeed healthy and on a private stay in Europe, in Geneva. But it was quite contrasting for a moment because the director of the civil cabinet, who is spending time with the president, said that he was working. The government spokesperson actually said the president was on a private stay. So Cameroonians are asking, is he working or is he on a private stay? That disconnect in government communication was something quite remarkable, some said. But more importantly, brought to bear the condition of President Paul Biya, who has basically, some would say, has been an absentee president, who spent most of considerable amount of time abroad, and Cameroonians rarely know when he's in the country or not.
That was Paul Ngea, the BBC reporter in Cameroon. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.